The Moon in Her House, or Why Cats Do Not Weep, by Cat Kingsgrave. There have always been tigers in the world, my love, even from the very first of days. Wherever men have walked, there was one or another of that grand sort. Lions, leopard, lynx, and pale ounces, fleet cheetah, jaguar, and tigers without pity, all stalking proud-pawed and lordly through jungle, desert, peak, and plain. Men learnt well to fear them, for, to such twilight lantern eyes, a man is not much different from a deer, goat, or pig, save that he is often slower. And how could men not wonder, eyeing the brindled flank of she who dozes in the sunlit window, the bundled haunch of he who hunts dust-mice beneath the sofa, the comfortable burr of she who warms a lap in a chill spring evening? Does it not make them wonder how such fierce allies as these could have come down from the trees and into their ancestors' feeble campfire light without making a feast of them all? The answer's less to do with environmental adaptation, symbiotic domestication, and agrarian grain storage practices than dusty science likes to think. Bunk spread up like weeds to choke the gulf between tiger and tabby, leopard and longhair, monster and moggy. But bunk it remains. The truth, my dear, is a secret. No, actually, it's a secret. And in the tradition of secrets, it must be whispered into the safest of ears, lest it would chew and worry and gnaw and eat away at its bearer from the inside out, until only death remains to know the truth of it. This is the manner of secret that must be told, lest it kill by lingering poison, or lie forgotten until history coughs it up again, ripe, fermented, and dangerously heady. Whole worlds can become drunk on such secrets, beloved, drunk enough to burn. Of course your wits are sound, your tongue well-minded, and your shoulders look fit to bear up the truth of it. So come and sit close, warm and fire-warded with me. Pillow your head upon breathing fur, and I will tell you how the Queen of Secrets came to our lonely little world. It was long and long ago when she burst out, sleek and brilliant on the last gasp of light from a far and desperate star. He flung her forth, this dying star, and hurled her far from the darkness which closed him around, and hoped, perhaps, his legacy might see her to some better end than his. We may judge of that star now only by the fine silver claw which remains. This little queen, this quicksilver glimmer, furred thicker than comet's hair but warm as a sunrise glow. She was nimble and silent on velvet feet, with a ken for which way is up, and a knack for keeping those feet pointed the other. Well versed also in the making of one thing from the breaking of another, sprung as she had from the confluence of death and all secrets the old star had known. She was born knowing her name, and tell me, beloved, what creature draws first breath so wise as that? But her father star did not stir when the little queen spoke it, though the name raised bristling barbs upon her tongue and whetted her teeth, sharp and long. Comets rode through the old sun's grave, bristling and portentous, but they had no ear for the small queen, being temperamental, easily insulted, and never fully trustworthy. They ruffled her tail, frizzy and fat, but she let them pass by. The rocky bones that paved the grave only rattled, lifeless when she bespoke them. Amusing toys the dead cold things might be, but the game did not satisfy the burning urge in her to speak, to sing, to know, and to tell the truth of things aloud. Thus the queen resolved to wander, and wandering found her way to where a new young sun was king and very yellow. He gathered shining great jewel worlds in dancing patterns around him, and being a young and serious sun, he concerned himself chiefly with their patterns, not with the silvery queen who poked and patted and nosed out the secrets from each. Oh, delight to shave ice with her tongue and taste volcanoes hid deep within, to brush her starfire whiskers through softly humming clouds and fret eye storms like mice across their brindled surface, to sweep tail through dust-banded fields and clatter asteroids like seed pods in her wake, to rake her claws through chill dust in all the colors of things that bleed. But there was one jewel, one of the Yellow King's treasures which held treasures of its very own. And can we wonder, sweetling, that the little queen should find her way here, where great trees flock slow and stately across velvet plains, where mountains joust the blooming clouds across the face of forever, and oceans pearl the green with empyrean blue? Can we wonder that her wide little nose should lead her to where the first men huddled, small and brown, on the flanks of their campfires, and watched the darkness as though it held not wonders, but only death. And finding such a mystery there in the skirts of the night, how can we wonder that our fierce queen should decide to stay? In those days, you know, mankind's ken was different from what it is today. They knew the daytime was their strength, that they were beloved of the Golden King, and while not precisely protected by his brilliant regard, at least measurably safer while he held his course in the sky. And they understood that Fire loved them also, as much as she was able, and would consent, in his absence, to give them light, heat, and what protection she could. And Death, oh, Death did those men know far better than they wished. Death had swift paws, quick, sharp hooves, antlers eager to show blood into the air. Death tasted bitter as spring berries or too bright two toadstools. Death roared like water in narrow canyons, like tumbling snow on steep slopes, like stormlight hammering the ground in violent rage, like howling night hunters no firelight can reveal. Death stung like papery scorpions unseen underfoot, like weavers with more legs than patience, like honey hoarders, serpents, or stone-headed spears. Death screamed like great eagles in stoop, an ounce aloft ranging her leap, like a heavy branch tearing loose far overhead. Death was the color of night-time. All men knew this. It was vast, pitiless, patient, and hungry, and it ruled all things the sun left to darkness. All things, of course, but fire. Death was bigger in those days than it is now. It came to the firelight wardings of men as a single solid darkness. It batwing whispered that fuel might burn faster than planned and run out before dawn. It panther growled that rain might come and douse the flames. It snatched with thorny legs those not close enough to the light and dragged them away so quick there was no scream, only a gulp of surprise, and then Death's sated sigh. O tyrant is the steward when the king cannot attend. O cruel is he that cannot rule but for another's say. O merciless the whispering dark when naught was left to burn. What could men do in such straits but try to appease the great unseen? Death cared not for gold or jewels, though. It wanted no sacraments of soft pelts, bright beads, or steel, but secrets. Oh, secrets were sweet. Trickling from nerve-parched tongues at the firelight's wavering edge, sipped from cold lips and swallowed down, never to gurgle into knowing again. The first secret Death ate was of exactly what Death wanted with secrets, the birthright of all who walked the earth to begin with. Perhaps Death was building a great rustling hoard of them, or twisting and braiding them into armor, all glittering spikes and searing hooks, for what is more painful than truth, except a secret abused? Perhaps it merely took them in, crunched them up small, savored their knowing that none save itself should ever know again. Death is greedy, after all. That secret is well known even to this day. So let us imagine what our Silver Queen saw when she followed her whiskers down to the satin sands. Let us picture night, thick and black as was nothing else in the world. It will do to picture the belly of the deepest cavern, where even now, some wise part of you knows, Death lurks still. That is almost darkness enough. Imagine sand, warm with sunlight's memory under tender paws, but air so chilly dry it tears breath from between the teeth and spins it into steam unseen. Imagine whispers of grass, and possibly voices, rattle of scrub or of chattering teeth that tickle your ears on the breezeless air. Imagine the smell of still water and sand, and of green things growing, but no glimmer of sight, no shimmer of light to show you where these things might be. Death was big enough, in those days, to block out even the watchful stars. Still, our little queen was kitted for blackness and cold, having travelled quite some time in the void. She merely fluffed up her silvery fur, tucked her paws to the warm sand, and waited. And soon enough, Death crept up, close and curious to the silvery gleam. "You are not very big," it said, all growl and gloat. "I am big enough," the queen answered, and flicked a spark from one ear. "I have eaten things 20 times the size of you," Death said, in a rattle of bone and failing breath. "Mighty hunters with teeth like sabres, mammoth mountains of muscle and bone, camels, sloth, and bison have I taken by thousands, and here you sit alone. What's to stop me eating you as well?" At that the queen opened one eye, green as her old son's last gasp, flexed her claws in the sand. "Do try," she invited, politely showing her neat, pointed teeth. "You are too far for the fire to save you," Death said, intrigued at that Viridian glance, but beginning to guess that here sat more than just a queer small creature. "There stands a high dune between, and you are quite alone. But I will spare your life if you tell me your secret." For all things which lost their secrets became somehow less. Less lucky, less canny, less curious, less wild, less themselves, and a little more belonging to Death. And whoever said Death was not lazy? But the queen only smiled and stretched, so the stardust aurora sparked and popped along her spine. "I will tell you your secret," she said when she had finished, "if you've courage enough to hear it." And at that, Death was taken aback and not a little worried. It had no notion of which of its treasured secrets she might have stolen, let alone how she'd managed it, and it greatly feared growing less in any way. It was that worry that stopped Death leaping upon the little queen and devouring her at once. "Thief! You have no secret of mine!" it shouted. "Then tell me at once!" "I am no thief," she purred into the startled dark. "I found this secret on the corpse of a son you have never seen, but it is true as teeth and talons. You are not the only Death there is," she purred, "and I have bested bigger of your kind." And with that she turned herself inside out, as starlights wont to do, pierced the whelming darkness like a razor, and slipped sidelong through the crack. A shocked thunder slapped the face of the air in her wake, and then, with an outraged gasp, the night began to rage. Picture a young woman now, my dear, trembling reed-like in the storm as she whispers to the darkness at the campfire's twilight edge. With her face swaddled against the blowing sand, she breathes her only secret into the great beast's rage. "I have not bled in too long," she says, and hopes the hot red words, or perhaps those of her kindred nearby, and likewise whispering, might be enough to sate it. "Not since just before the tribes gathered at the oasis of the Black Goat Rock," she says. "Not since I danced in my green robes for the elders, and again without them for the one whose smile shone so brightly." Eyes closed against the sand, how easy to remember that smile, much harder now for it to warm her as it had then. "But I do not know if my mother will smile at me when I give her another child to feed before winter." One hand curls around her little belly, the other gripping robes, veil and cowl tight over her thundering heart as she gathers up the courage to beg. To beg, though all knew there was no pity in Death. "Even so, please do not take him away, this little one. Not so soon as this. Not before I know his laugh and hear him speak his name." She stops, breath caught between a scream and a gritty linen choke, for something, neither sand nor serpent, has just curled past her leg. How her mind whirls with terrible endings, how she rushes back to the beleaguered fire's glow, back to where Death's claws may not quite reach. But first she trips, this light-footed one who danced for the elders, trips and tangles and sprawls out flat on the sand. Heart pounding like drum skin in her throat, the girl shakes loose her robes, and from the whipping snarls tumbles a creature the like of which she has never seen. A little like a panther in the flat, broad silver head and prickling whiskers, only it does not scream or leap upon her. A little like a jackal in the pointed ears tucked down flat against the skull, save that it has not snarled or lunged for her throat. A little like a wolf in the jagged smoke-ridged spine, the water-weed fluff of tail, save that it voices no bone-rattling howl to summon its hungry kin. And in the slitted green eyes of the beast, the girl glimpses equal parts serpent, sun, and slight. Perhaps, had her secret fallen to Death's greed, had she become less for the losing of it, our girl might have screamed and kicked and fled to the fire. But as it has not, she spies out another mystery welling up within that lantern gleam, and it holds her enchanted. The strangling creature is our little queen, of course, rumpled and vexed at the indignities of clumsy foot and tangling robes, but a better sight than the yawning maw of Death the dancing girl had expected. Uncertain, leery of disturbing the muted offerings of her tribe, the girl gathers her courage and offers her hand to the strange little beast, who sniffs those painted fingers with suspicion, due an interstellar intelligence who's outwitted a young rash Death, only to find her tail trodden upon by mortal toes. Then, because she was ever the forgiving sort, and because the fire seemed hard done by in Death's blowing tantrum, The silvery queen rubs her head along the girl's palm and purrs a note of absolution. The girl scratches just there, behind the ear that's been buzzing ever since death shouted in it, and the queen leans in hard, closing her eyes for a moment of pure bliss. But then she leaps away, shaking dust and starlight from her fur, and goes to tell the struggling fire the secret of burning as suns do, for the burning alone, though air and fuel there is none to be had. She thinks the poor thing could use it. Thus the tribe lived through the storm, though they never knew just how. The dancing girl suspected, and made a nest of her fine green robes for the Silver Queen. And our queen, intrigued by this folk so clever and so helpless at once, travelled on with the tribe, growing fat and round with desert mice, proffered tidbits, and, of course, on secrets. For she was ever close when the tribe would venture to the gloom to whisper their accustomed sacrifices, and with clever ears she caught them, kenned them, and held them fast in her knowing. And with each one she whisked away, the queen felt the life of the secret quicken inside her growing belly. And she curled up round and bright and tight in her nest of green linen, and she purred, as she did when well stroked and well fed. But later, when the camp was a muted tapestry of sleepy breath and wheedling snores, she would slip from ear to ear, and whisper those same secrets back to their owners. And so her tribe did not become less, and that vexed greedy death terribly, you may be certain. In time, of course, the Silver Queen brought forth those secrets again, blind and mewling at first, but each one precious, seedling wise, and hungry to learn the ways of the jewel world they trod for home. They were not born quite so full of knowing as their dam, but they were made all of secrets, cunning, and hope, and in the death-stalked opal world there were few things quite so clever to be found. They learnt the keeping of secrets. They learnt the sidelong leap of light round corners. They learnt the sleeping tongue of men, and the way of seeing past the shape of a thing to ken the truth of it beneath. And, too, they learnt the lesser men's fear, which for them meant violence, and so learnt to keep clear of those who had sold their greater away in fear of death. And as the queen's chosen tribe was a wandering band, whose road cross-knit with many others, her get spread quicker than seed fluff across the desert and beyond. The kits came fast and furry, and all did need to eat. Their mother sent them forth to travel whenever tribe met tribe, with a sizzling kiss to the flat of their heads, and a face-press hug of warning to be bold, be quick, and watch the tricksy twilight close. Soon enough, wherever death found men gathered in firelight, it also found lantern eyes watching from the gloom, found sleek, slippery spies listening when humankind gave up its secrets in the vain hope of mercy, tickling whiskers giving those secrets back to them in smug, rumbling purrs. And two may keep a secret indeed, but not if one is death, wasting what remains of the other into bone and skin and twitching eyeless sleep. Those secrets do not keep for long at all once the heart gives out. Death began to wonder, eventually, if cats themselves might not do better for its hoard. But cats are hard to catch, as any who has tried soon learns, and harder still to kill. They know in their bones the secret of luck and leap, twist and tickle, folds, flicker, spindle, sprint, and miracles the keenest eye cannot follow. They know these things at birth, just as they know their names, and the meat of the secret that gives their coat its color. What color, my sweet? Why, can you not see the scorched blush of a shame at face, tail, and foot? The gingered ruddy haunch of a hatred, icy white whiskers of a terror, misty gray of a soft despair, or the gleaming golden flank of a love? And the black cats wear their secrets too, but slyly, velvet silence spread like the void around the inevitable spark. Do those who guess it gain a knowing beyond their sisters? Many witches have believed it, and many black cats have encouraged that supposition too. Find a black cat and ask. Its answer may startle you. But yes, dearest one, cats know from birth just who they are and what they ought to do. And even those who travelled far from the queen's sight still doused their mother's distant love in their bones, buzzing with contentment and the old sun's ghostly memories, their birthright. Who would not purr as well? The chosen people built up cities in time, learnt the secrets of coin, ashlar, and arch, of keystone and capstone, and level and plumb. And they raised them up monuments not even death's temper could knock down. Perhaps their canny cats taught them this, the legacy of all a dying star once did know, or perhaps the cats just made sure the knowing of these things, once they came to the tribes of men, did not slip away into darkness' greedy ears. And perhaps that was why, on some certain nights, all cats, grey in the darkness, blurred and purred together. And when that rumbling, futtering, smugly fluttering sound filled up the empty night with hope, for which death had neither taste nor use, death swore it would tolerate no more. No more of pillars and avenues, no more of brick and mortar and city walls with fire hid safe in lantern glass, no more of oil burned to the wick, houses snug against the storm, and hearth-tamed threshold hounds. No more of men who knew no taste of terror, or spell-weaving, luck-healing women, tickling loose death's grasp on their kin. In a rage, death left the third world, the shining sphere of beryl and pearl, and went to find the king. It packed its dark bulk, as solid and tight as it could go, into the shadow of the closest treasure to the king, where it growled in the voice of tigers, "I have heard that sons may die." "Sons may do many things, I suppose," the young king answered, attention fixed on the architecture of his game. "Even if they do not know that they know, I am not surprised." He rolled a bit of dust into a ball beside a distant little treasure, and sent it carefully spinning. "What is this dying you speak of, and how is it done?" Clenched tight in its pocket of shadow, death was cramped and uncomfortably hot, and beginning to doubt its plan, but it pressed along all the same. "To cease, to stop, to burn no more," it guessed, and knew from the echoing ghost of its stolen secrets that the guess was pretty much correct. "To spin your toys loose into cold silence, and care no more which dances more brightly. To taste of nothing, to know nothing, to forget and be forgotten. This is what dying is, and I am that which will bring the dying upon you." The young king thought about this. Within his roaring light, a knelling whisper of, "Yes, this could just be truth," arose, unsettling and vexing at once. "I should prefer you did not," he said, and finally peered about for the source of the voice, "for then I should have to fight you." He did not say that he should prefer not to have to fight anyone at all, of course, for he was a son, and not entirely a fool. Only he had just added several delicate moons to the pavane of his two biggest treasures, and he worried for their precision should he split his attention for war-making. "Sons die all the same," the voice went on, growing more and more sure of itself. "Think you that other doomed stars have not fought in vain?" The sun considered. Then, "I think you lie, voice in the darkness," the sun lied himself. As any who have seen the promise of shimmering water or far delicate cities where no cities stand can witness, the sun is an excellent liar. "I think you sow deception, and hide your true intent, and so I will not trust you." "And if I bring you proof?" asked Death, beginning to smoulder in his lessening shelter, as the king's attention drew in. "There is a creature I have seen, who has the death of suns caught in her fur, who peers as stars do with a light where darkness ought to linger, a thieving thing, all silver and guile, but witness to this dying I bring." "And where is this creature?" asked the king, heedless as his tiny golden world began to boil. "If such a creature exists within my sphere, I should have the knowing of it." Ah, how sad a thing that even kings aloft in heaven may be led astray by pride. "Just there," Death Jackal yelped, "on the third world, nacreous with life. Just there, where the sands lie smooth and long, and the green river floods the delta with mud. There, where the gold gleams from atop bold and bothersome mountains. Look for her where the mud is carved into awful green roves, and shunts steal life from the great brown flow. Look for her there, and you will see." And the king, with eyes fiercer than any falcon, did look there. And he did find her, sleeping all in a blaze on the paw of a great stone creature, that was not unlike herself a little, which guarded three mountains no earth shift had ever raised. Her caravan had come to the place for trade with settled folk, you see, and it amused the queen to doze where secrets gathered. The Yellow King saw the little queen, bulging full with life, her flanks sound and round as starlight, her paws neatly tucked, her comet's tail curled over her toes like a pearl haze over mountains. The sun saw her, this child of death and secrets, this fierce little mother creature asleep on golden sands, and forgot all at once what it might be like to die. For suddenly he knew what it was to love. Ah, shall I tell you how he wooed her? Shall I tell you what songs he sang in his mighty voice? How all his dancing worlds took up in harmony and improvised extra flourishes of joy? Shall I tell you of their whispered flirtations, their dancing seductions? And shall I tell you how gleeful Death became when it saw the Silver Queen grow careless and in love? Oh no, there are a dozen tales and more to braid out that great tangle of love and betrayal. Tales that have found their way into the knowing of all men's stories, though the details change with the tongue that tells it. What matters is that Death did come upon the Silver Queen one unwary night, that he did catch her up in his great claws, that he did gobble her down, yes, and all the squirming kittens inside her, in a single gulp. But there he made his error, for even as his black maw flexed around her, our queen gave that sidelong leap, that spinning flicker of inside from out, and she leapt away with all the strength of her wiry satin feet. Oh, how the thunder crashed in Death's throat! How it roared and belled and shattered the great beast into a million pieces, each no bigger than a mouse on the sands! And how those stunned and terrified pieces of Death did scatter when the children of the Silver Queen, summoned from all roads and all firesides and all stone and timber cities by her startled cry, did fall upon them with lantern eyes and steely claws and quickly crunching teeth. And it might have been a victory complete, but for this. The little Silver Queen had missed her mark when she leapt for safety. And now she found herself aloft in the sky, too far from her tribe of men to shepherd their secrets, too far from her get to rumble their bones with adoration. She was far and far and far beyond the reach of campfire dances, green linen nests, warm stone paws, and quick desert mites, and treats smuggled off the table. Perhaps the sun, her lover, had caught the queen's flight, curbed her careening tumble, and set her carefully to circle the world of opals she had so loved, so that she might always see it, and he might always see her. Or perhaps it was the opal world herself who caught the queen just at that point in the sky, so round and sound and full of secrets that she could not but gleam with the young king's love, and light the darkness Death no longer ruled. Or perhaps it was only luck. But one thing is certain, when her children looked up from their fleeting feast of Death, and let the tiny shards slip chittering from between their claws, when they realized she was gone, oh, how they mourned their mother's loss. They cried for her, they called for her, they yowled with all anguish the secrets of which they had been born, trying, in the only way they knew, to bridge her back from that cold, far distance. Can you imagine such a sound, darling? Can you picture the dreadful screaming threaded through with great and awful truths no man or woman or child thought ever to hear from living lips? Can you imagine those thousands of anguished lungs singing the secrets aloud in the panoply of to the night that, while no longer occluded with Death, was still dark and wide and full of listening ears? Can you imagine the fear, the rage in the tribes who heard? How quick they must have taken up their killing tools, their slings, their clubs, their scythes and swords, to silence those woeful bristling tongues. The queen from her vantage saw, and she knew in her bones that Death might yet silence her legacy, coming now on flat, fearful human feet. But one last trick had she to play, for the death of the old sun had gifted her one secret, which she had kept only for herself. It was the secret of confusion, of forgetting, and of muddling sense into noise and dazzle, and she worked it not upon her children, but upon the rising tribes of men. She wove the airless song of space tightly around their blunt ears, so that to them the anguished song became a clamoring nonsense. She took from mankind the language of secrets, and grieved the theft from her airless orbit. And so you know, sweetling, how it is that the lithe moon grows so very full, and then thin again as the weeks pass by. It is secrets that fill her belly up there, the secrets of her lover, and of his treasures, and of what she sees up there so far beyond the world. And where do you suppose those secrets come once they are born? Why do they not come here, dearest, to her favorite opal world? And do they not whisper, tickling quick, to the dreaming ears of poets, philosophers, mathematicians, architects, witches, and babes, who may not fully understand what they dream, but at least retain the starlit hint in their eyes when they waken? And so now you know, beloved, why it is that cats stalk shadows, hunt unseen murmurs, and pounce and gobble quick nothings that leave neither fur nor smudge nor naked tail upon the rug, and why at twilight they are at their quickest, their wildest, their most lissome and ferocious, for when else do shadows meet and whisper and plan revenge? And you know, too, why there are always some few too fiercely free to heed the wards of door and window, too mad and sidelong to allow a kindly cage of man, even though they love the hand they dodge and the hearth they leave behind. The pool of their secret dries them like a tide, throbbing in their bones. They cannot but obey. And perhaps you now guess why some men hate cats, and others love them, and a little of why neither sort ever gives adequate explanation of it to the other. It is their secrets, of course, which decide the matter, but they, poor things, have lost both the knowing and the words to speak it. And what is this? What promised truth have I forgot to tell you? What sweetmeat held back unfair? Ah, yes. The reason cats do not weep is this. The moon, their mother, reached down her light to caress their woeful faces that night. She dried their tears to soot-streak and starshine, and whispered tidelong to their bones that she loved them still. And to this day the marks remain, the finger-pad smears of the mother's comfort sketched in glimmering fur across tiny faces in cozy litters, no matter the color and pattern of sire and dam. Like random benedictions these tiny tiger faces come, and when they are seen, all other cats smile in secret, knowing they are yet beloved of the moon, and that there is no need to weep.